Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today, I have a great guest on. She actually was nice enough to have me on her show called Night Vision Radio. Her name is Renee Barnett. So Renee is a lifelong researcher, veteran television producer specializing in entertainment, special series, documentaries, and reality-based programs. So Renee, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. And yes, you were recently on my show, and I wanted to say thank you once again for doing that. We had such a great response, and I had a lot of people asking questions about you later, and people also in the chat room that were live that night. They were saying, she's great. I love her. It was really nice. So thank you again. We had a great show that night.
No, it was my pleasure. But now let's talk about you, Renee. So let's start off giving people that are listening a little bit of history about who Renee is and then what really prompted you to be this lifelong researcher and then get into television producing.
Oh, gosh. Well, it kind of all just happened, you know, haphazardly, and then all sort of came together at one point. But what the research, you know, the particular research that I was on really started back in the early 80s, in about 1982, when I read a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And, you know, growing up in southeastern Oklahoma, right in the middle of the Bible Belt, those were some pretty radical ideas, because they were talking about things like Jesus being married and to Mary Magdalene, and maybe she wasn't just a hooker after all, and, you know, maybe she was really someone more important. And while I found those ideas kind of shocking and, you know, in some ways disturbing, because, you know, they sort of went counter to what I'd been taught as a child, I found it exciting, too, because to me it resonated a little bit more with how it seemed like it should have or would have been. And also, what it said to me was that there was something about, you know, Mary Magdalene's sort of being denigrated through history that to me just sort of felt like it sort of brought down women, you know, brought down all of us. And so if she had been denigrated, and, you know, and the stories were incorrect about her, then it would be interesting to see if, you know, we could find anything to the contrary. So that started, you know, a long, long journey of research and looking into different philosophies and going to the Gnostic Church here for a number of years in Los Angeles and just moving through a lot of different areas. And sort of I felt like, and later, that it had all been sort of giving me this huge background in this mystery or in this information. And I didn't even realize at the times when I was hopping around that these things were all connected and that that would become clear later. So, you know, then I was managing editor of UFO Magazine for a number of years in the 90s. And I was working on a column that dealt with the media and anything in the media that had to do with UFOs or something even vaguely related, like paranormal, then, you know, I would cover that in the magazine as well as, you know, I was a managing editor, but I also wrote. And so I was kind of hooked into the, you know, to Hollywood production in this genre. And then, so I got invited to for an interview at a place called Strange Universe that was a new show back in 1996. And went for an interview, and because of my sort of Rolodex at that time of, you know, all the people that I had met during the course of my research, that I'm pretty sure that's really why they hired me, because they said, oh, this will save us some time, you know. And so I worked on that show. It's full run. It went for 2 years. And that was my foray into television production. And went on from there and then continued my research and wasn't really applying that so much to my work in television until later when I formed my own company and was doing mostly just documentaries in the realm of, you know, the paranormal and hidden history and that sort of stuff. So that got me to, you know, starting to work on the idea for the film Bloodline.
which is, you know, it all led up to where it needs to be. But yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about a little bit before Bloodline, and then we're going to really get into Bloodline because I have some pretty interesting questions that maybe you can answer, and if not,
I sure
we'll
hope
find maybe we'll find the answer.
I hope I don't pull a Rick Perry on you and forget about what I was going to say.
I'll
forgive me. I've been with grandchildren all weekend. Yeah.
I know how that goes. I'll send you a psychic poke. How's that?
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take it.
Now, you did a little bit with Ripley's Believe It or Not. So,
oh, my gosh. See, you've been looking, you've been investigating. Yes, I did. I was the co-producer of Ripley's Believe It or Not for a couple of seasons, and that was late 90s, I believe. It took me up to about 99 or something like that.
You know, so when you were doing Ripley's Believe It or Not, while you were there, what was the most fascinating story that you covered?
Oh, my goodness. There were so many. And I mean, you know, I don't know whether fascinating, but I mean, there were certainly some that were memorable because they were very bizarre, you know. Like, I have to say, this is really strange, and I don't know what this says about me, but the first story that comes to mind is we had a story called Footbinder, and there was a young woman in San Francisco that was Asian, and she practiced the art, and she bound her own feet, you know, as they used to bind the women's feet, and it was actually, you know, kind of torturous, or not kind of torturous, but torturous and disfiguring and everything else, but she did it as sort of a, you know, kind of a sexual fetish type thing, but she would bind her feet, you know, so we, you know, measured her foot, you know, before she bound it up, and then she bound him up, and she, you know, it was like her foot was like, I forgot how many inches smaller, but it was just, I just thought it was, you know, bizarre and really kind of hilarious. I mean, those are, as you can imagine, the stories. I was in charge of all the stories. I was the co-producer, and my job was what's called the front end of the show, and I was in charge of, you know, finding all the stories and then shooting all the stories and then turning them over to post-production, and then my co-producer was in charge from writing on through post-production. So as you can imagine, it was kind of interesting, you know, all the different stories and the people that we came across. I don't know why Footbinder... You know, we had everything from, you know, the giant ball of twine to the guy with the backwards feet to, you know, strange, you know, bodies of strange unidentifiable animals, you know, to, oh, my goodness. So we had the guys that, you know, put hooks in their backs and suspended themselves. And I went to the shoot for that. And, you know, I was back there when they were putting the hooks in their backs, and it was all I could do not to pass out watching those hooks go into their skin. It was like, it was bizarre. And then they suspended them, and we made, oh, this is just crazy sounding, but we made like a giant mobile, human mobile, and with these people, and they were like swinging around, and I'll never forget, one of them passed out. And kind of went shocky, you know. And I thought, you know, this is insane, you know. It's like, are we really doing this? But it's really crazy. So, yeah, that was some of my Ripley's experiences.
One thing that you did that would really interest me a lot is the Unmasked, Exposing the Secrets of Deception. Because there's a lot of deception going on.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because it was a bit of a debunking type show, which I kind of wasn't used to or really into, except that I really want to believe a lot of things, and I'm open to a lot of things, but I'm kind of the type of person that I really want to see it for myself, and I want to be able to prove it somehow for myself. And so I guess this wasn't too far off the mark, but yes, I had, in fact, it was the husband of the executive at TBS who was over our Ripley show. Her husband, it was his show, and I guess she had recommended me from when I was at Ripley's. And that was, we did several things. The most interesting thing to me was that we did have some guys create a crop circle, and we shot it in time-lapse photography, and it was absolutely gorgeous, and it's actually online. You can find it. I think it's called NBC Crop Circle or something. This was for an NBC special, as you said, called Unmasked, Exposing the Secrets of Deception. And, you know, everybody was saying there's no way a person could make, you know, humans could make a crop circle overnight like that. And, you know, we were saying, well, basically, we're not saying that we know the origins of all these crop circles, but yes, you can do it. It can be done. And so we had these guys, and we flew them down to New Zealand because it was the only place at that time of year where the wheat was at the right height and everything. So we flew them down there and filmed it overnight. And it turned out it was just beautiful. It was just gorgeous. But a lot of people were angry about that because, you know, they felt like we were debunking crop circles as a whole, and we weren't really doing that. I mean, you can't say what made every single crop circle. You know, there's just no way to know, but I do know that it can be done.
Oh, yeah, it can be done. And I'm sure it aggravated a lot of people, Renee, only because they want to have this belief that this is something that truly is from, you know, aliens someplace. And for somebody to turn around and debunk that probably made a lot of the people mad. However, there are many, many crop circles that are for real. And, you know, so, and I can imagine people going, oh, she's just trying to make it look bad. But, you know, it needs to be done because people need to understand that there are many people out there who want people to be gullible and believe anything and everything they say or do. And in reality, you know, that's not good for people. They've got to question things. They've got to look into things, even for their own good. I mean, even if they don't want to believe it after they look into it, at least they're looking into it. You know, that's real important, I think. And a lot of people today, Renee, I don't think they do that. I think they listen to that good old boob tube, and whatever comes out of that tube, it has to be truth. And whatever comes out of that boob tube, in my opinion, is a lot of lies. But, you know, people need to find out things for themselves and then, you know, decide if they want to believe it or not. I mean, it has been proven that crop circles are real. You know, I've interviewed Colin Andrews, and I'm interviewing Patty Greer.
Yes.
You know, people like that, you know, who can prove it. You know, the other thing that you're doing that really fascinates me, and I'm going to tell you why after I tell you, it's you being part of the production team for The Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura on True TV. I would love to interview him, okay?
Yeah, well, I'll let him know. Yeah, he is quite a character, and he's really interesting, an interesting person. I mean, I guess I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know, but he really is passionate about what he does, and he's very, very interesting, and he's very nice. I'm not with him every single day, of course, but when I've met him and everything, I've really had good feelings about him, and of course, I work with his son, who's part of the team, and I see him more regularly because he lives here in Los Angeles, and then we also have Sean Stone, who's part of the on-camera team, who is the son of Oliver Stone, so it's really interesting.
It was funny when I moved down to New Mexico the first year that I was here. I actually moved in, it's going to be 3 years ago this coming April, but in October of that year, I brought David Icke to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and people from, you know, True TV wanted to interview him, and so we actually got that set up and stuff, and they interviewed him, and they called back, and they wanted to interview him again, but he's really hard to get a hold of now. But, you know, Jesse Ventura, I love to bring him in as a fundraiser, help raise money for my school, so I'd like to talk to you about that. But now let's talk about this other thing that fascinates me to no end, and that is the UFO. Now, when you were working with the UFO magazine, was there anything that was kind of outstanding or surprising or kind of freaky that came through?
Well, there was quite a bit of stuff, you know, because I was there for a number of years, and it was pretty interesting. And again, you know, I got into that because I did develop an interest in the subject myself and, you know, took a little sojourn into UFO research for a while. I was really fascinated by people who were saying that, you know, they were having these personal experiences, and I was actually part of a founding a group called CIRO, Close Encounter Research Organization, here. And Yvonne Smith, who's a hypnotherapist, still actually has that group going. But she and I, and I, you know, I feel bad, but it seems like there was one more person. It's been so long ago. Started that group. And during the course of that, I believe I met Vicki Cooper, who was the publisher and editor-in-chief of UFO Magazine. And so we chatted, and I ended up going to work there part-time for a while, and then ended up staying on and becoming managing editor. And then I was also at that same time doing a radio show with her husband, Don Ecker, who was the research director for the magazine. Don Ecker and Dwight Schultz, who's from Star Trek and the A-Team. He's an actor and has a real passion for UFOs. And so we did that show. And interestingly, or not, but interesting to me, Jeff Floro was one of the he and I were producing the show for Don. And I was the announcer. And then now Jeff is my producer on the show that I'm doing now, you know, 15, 16 years later. So it's kind of fun. We're back together doing radio again. But let's see, one of the most interesting things that came through there was the alien autopsy material and footage. And it actually, and I've heard differing stories about this, but the way I remember it was that story actually came to Don Ecker first. And he called a producer in town, and that producer and he were going to do something with this material. I guess there was some really dark footage or something, you know, that Don had been sent, and some information on some names and things like that. So the next thing, anyway, to make a long story short, Don kind of got cut out of it. The next thing we heard, this producer had headed to London to talk to Ray Santilli, who was the guy that had the footage. And Don kind of got cut out of the deal. But that, of course, went on to be, they did three airings of that on Fox. They aired it as a special. Then they aired it with additional footage. And then they aired it and debunked it themselves. They debunked themselves. And they made millions and millions of dollars.
Of course.
And that producer became very, very wealthy and had a big, big house in Malibu that, you know, we always call it, you know, the house that Alien Autopsy bought. But anyway, so that was quite an interesting thing that came across. But there were, you know, there were other things as well. And, you know, one thing that surprised me the most, I guess, at that time, especially because I had been sort of researching UFOs for only just maybe a few years by the time I was at UFO Magazine, maybe 5 years or something like that. And all the stories that I'd heard about, you know, agents and, you know, CIA and all this other stuff and MIBs and everything, I never once felt like, and neither did Don or Vicki, because I asked them about it, felt like they were being told to keep quiet or that they were being, you know, spied on or anything like that. And I thought, well, you know, because it was kind of a clearinghouse for UFO information, because people would send us, you know, information or photographs or videotapes of their sightings and things like that. And I was kind of surprised, because I thought surely there would be something, you know, that somebody would be interested in, but we didn't ever see any evidence of any, you know, any spying or anything like that, or any government intervention.
Probably if you did it now, you would probably get that government spying and stuff. You know, there's a town that's close to New Mexico. It's like right on the borderline between New Mexico and Arizona, called Dulce. And Dulce is like, it's supposed to be, and I've talked to a lot of people about it, Dulce is supposed to be an underground alien base. And there's a lot of things that go on in and around that area. and it's stuff like a lot of the American Native Indians are there, you know, and they won't talk to you unless they really, really trust you. And if they do, they actually have pictures of things that are just totally unbelievable. One of the people that I had at my conference, his name is Norio Hayakawa. He used to go there every year and do like a small conference there, and the people got used to seeing him, so they started to trust him a little bit from what I understand. And they got to see some pretty wild pictures of things going on there. And Dulce, if you don't know anything about Dulce, you might want to look it up. I think they have like 2,500.
I do know about Dulce. It is very interesting. It's really wild. And one of my most intriguing stories, you know, I was going to say this next, is about Dulce, and it's the Paul Banowitz story. That was a really interesting, and I really still think that there's so much more to it. And, you know, I know I've got friends that have researched it a lot, and like Greg Bishop, and he's recently published a book about it. And, you know, I just think there's a little bit more that was going on than, you know, it's like they sort of explained it away. Like, oh, well, we were, you know, using disinformation. He was losing his mind, so he was seeing things. And, you know, but I really think there were things that he was seeing and that, you know, it was sort of a double back disinformation thing. I think they were, you know, disinforming him. But I don't think that that means that he did not see anything.
Yeah, Greg was also one of my speakers at the conference that I had.
Oh, I love Greg. You know, he hosts my show for me when I'm gone to France or somewhere on one of my tours.
He's
wonderful.
Good. Yeah. You'll have to tell him I said hi to him. You know, I would like to go to Dulce, but everybody, and this is no lie, everybody that knows about Dulce that I think could take me on a nice tour, they're going, Nancy, you don't want to go there. And I go, yeah, but I really do. And they go, no, you don't. Read my lips. No, you don't. And it's like, oh. You know, so it's like I'm itching to go there, but I have to go with some people who really know what they're doing, because I don't think I would go there just by myself to try to see anything. But I think it'd be a really interesting show to go there and do a show from there. So that might be in the works. You never know.
And I was talking with someone the other day, somebody that has done a lot of research into the Dulce area, and I said, you know, has anybody ever really done a definitive documentary about Dulce? And he said, no, they really never have. And so strangely, I got an email from another Dulce researcher within the day or so, saying that there's a film that's being developed about Dulce Base. And interestingly, one of the producers of the film is a guy that I know. And I said, oh my gosh, because they said, oh, he said he knows you. And I said, oh my gosh, he worked with me on Ripley's. I friended him on Facebook, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him to find out what's the dealio, but it sounds interesting. It would make an incredible film in so many different ways. I mean, depending on, there's so many different parts and facets of that story.
Mm-hmm. No, maybe he'll let us come down and see him for a little bit. That would be a great idea. But we'll talk about that when we're not on the phone. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the feature that you're producing. It's called Bloodline. So explain it a little bit more, because we kind of went over it quickly, but let's talk about Bloodline now and let's see where it goes.
Okay. Well, Bloodline, you know, it's already out. It's a film that was that I produced that actually what we were doing, it's funny because it was before even the Da Vinci Code book came out. It was about a mystery that's surrounding a little French village called Rennes-le-Château that has to do with, you know, a secret and some strange goings-on in that village, but the secret seemed to have something to do with Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And when the Da Vinci Code book came out, I recognized buried in that, you know, all these connections to the Rennes-le-Château mystery, including connections to the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and them even being featured in a sort of amalgamated character, Lee Teabing, in the Da Vinci Code. But as I said, we were already working on this. When the Da Vinci Code book came out, we got hold of Michael Bajant, who's one of the authors of Holy Blood, and he came over, and we started working on a project with Fox Studios that was going to be a television series, and we worked on it for about a year, and then suddenly the president of Fox left and went to Paramount Pictures, and all of her executives left, and all their projects just got shelved, including ours. So we said, oh my goodness, what do we do now? And Michael Bajant said, you know, I'm fed up with this U.S. TV stuff, you know, and we said, we don't blame you. And he went back to England, and we said, okay, we're going to carry on. So we took the Da Vinci Code book, and right at the beginning, I think it's on page 6, Dan Brown sets out, like, a few facts. He says, fact, Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, and they had a bloodline that is carried on to this day, and this secret is protected by a secret society called the Priory of Zion, something like that. So we decided to set out to see whether we could prove any evidence one way or the other for this marriage and this bloodline, and to see whether or not we could prove the existence of this secret society, and if we could crack into it. So that's what we did. We set out, and we ended up cracking into this group and getting some leads from them on, you know, evidence to look for. And in the course of the film, I found a guy called Ben Hammett in England who had found a tomb in France. And so we hooked up with Ben, and we started going around with him and following clues that we found buried in the countryside in bottles. We found those clues following clues that were in the church in that little village called Rennes-le-Château, and found the bottles in the countryside. And each one that we would find, each clue, would lead to a next clue. Finally, they led us to a buried chest. And the last clue that we found, the last bottle clue, said that, you know, we were looking for a chest, and that in the chest was the cup of Jesus and Mary and the anointing jar. And so we did find this little buried chest in a cave, and, you know, it was buried. It was underground, and it had a cup, a pottery cup in it, and an unguentarium, or an anointing jar. And it had another little vial with a parchment in it rolled up. And the vial and the cup and the jar all dated to first century Jerusalem. And this was, of course, found in southwest France. It doesn't say that they belong to Jesus and Mary Magdalene, but it certainly is the right time frame, you know, and it was very interesting. There was also a collection of coins that dated from about 100 B.C. to up through the Crusades. So we were trying to figure out why that sequence of coins. Was it denoting a period of time? Was there other clues in those coins? And we've sort of put them out there for people to tell us, you know, if you see anything, if you can think of anything, what this might mean. But and then we were able to get into the tomb, into the cave, and we only had access through a hole in the bottom of the cave that we were able to get a endoscopic camera down and film around in the tomb. But inside that tomb, you can see a shrouded body with a big red cross on it. And you can see chests of treasure. That there's a chest that's full of, like, chalices and coins and jewels. And there's also several scrolls that are, like, lying around on the floor. I think they got knocked down in a rock fall, because they're has been some rockfall activity in there. And then on one side of the room, there's a blocked-up doorway. So we don't know where that goes or what that might lead to or who that body is or what those scrolls say. And there's also a huge old book that's sitting there on a table that's, you know, sort of rotting away. So the thing to do, of course, is to excavate that tomb and find out, you know, what all those things mean, if or to the extent that we can.
And so if if you're going to go to excavate it, what would you have to do in order to do that?
We would have to petition the French government, and we would have to get an archaeologist first that they would approve. So they have a list of archaeologists, or we could choose one of our own, and as long as they're bona fide and qualified in the area of expertise that they need to be for such a excavation of a tomb, then that gets approved, and then that archaeologist is in charge of the excavation. And it would be a lot of money involved because it's, you know, thick rock, and the only way, unless we can find the real entrance, and we've looked and looked and looked for several years, is to go down through that hole, and you'd have to blast it, and you'd have to shore it up, and a lot of different things in order not to cave it in on the whole thing, because the body is right underneath the actual opening. So it's kind of an undertaking. But it's not up to me. It's up to the French government, and it's also up to the finder, the discoverer of the tomb, who's the official discoverer, is Ben. And so when he and the French government, you know, work it out, you know, I'm going to be there, hopefully, to film it all. I assume that I will be. I still... Ben is, you know, I do the tours to France and also to the UK, and I'm going to start some tours within the United States this coming year also. But Ben usually helps us out on the tours, and so I keep in close contact with him. So if there's any activity around that tomb, I'm going to know about it.
That would be great. You know,
make sure I don't let him get too far away.
No, I wouldn't. You know, it could change the course of what everybody thinks. You know, it could also change the course of the Bible and what has been written in it. Is it true, or has it just been rewritten so many times, reinterpreted so many times that it's just the story? So I think that would be a pretty important finding, you know, if you guys get to do that. So tell me a little bit about the priority of Zion. What are they?
Oh, well, it's they're a shadowy group, sort of. What I can figure out, and you know, I don't think anybody really knows. But from what I can see, they're sort of a loosely connected group of people in Europe, and you know, there's supposedly a contingent in North America, in the United States, and maybe in Canada. Of people who seem to have a lot of connections and a lot of, they seem to be important people. They're not the kings, but they're like the kingmakers. They're the people behind the people. And the person that I know the best that, you know, we feel that we have substantiated is a priory spokesman is Nicholas Haywood, and we interview him and another priory member, Gino Sondry, in the film. And I don't know Gino as well. One reason being is that my French isn't the greatest, and he only speaks French, so it, you know, sort of naturally fell that I, you know, would become better acquainted with Nicholas Haywood. And because he's English, and I had a very interesting experience with him. The first time that we met, we had, you know, scheduled this meeting with him, and so we flew over. My partner and I flew over, and we met up with Robert Howells, who is in the film Bloodline. He was a researcher for us in the film. And in fact, he's just released a new book that's just fabulous called Inside the Priory of Zion. And he is a smart, smart guy. And I haven't read the whole book yet, but I'm definitely going to. And when I was in France a couple weeks ago, my co-director, Gloria Amendola, happened to have her copy with her, and I snagged it while we were there and read most of it. And it's very well written, and I was very, very pleased and proud of Rob that he did such an amazing job. And he spent a lot of years on it, and he knows his stuff. But anyhow, met Nick Haywood. So at this particular time, we were supposed to meet up with this guy. He named the meeting place and the time and everything. We were just supposed to show up at this place. And I didn't know, you know, what he looked like or, you know, anything. I didn't know. I don't even think I knew his name at that time. And we waited, and we were like, oh, my goodness. And he walks in finally. Bob goes out in the hallway and finds him wandering around, and he brings him in. And he says, I have 1 hour for you. And we said, okay. And we go, well, we better get to talking quick then, you know. So we sit down, and we were yakking away. And before we knew it, we looked up, and it was 6 hours later. But it was the oddest experience because my business partner was like firing questions at him just nonstop, and it was like he wasn't even quite listening to the answer before he would ask the next question. And it was really funny because he would ask a question and then Nicholas would answer him, and my partner would say, oh, you mean XYZ? And Nick, instead of saying yes or no, would turn and look at me and sort of turn his head to the side like, please explain to him what I mean. And I would say, no, what he means is blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, that went on for 6 hours. And I'm thinking, why is it that I know what he's thinking? And I feel like he knows what I'm thinking. It was the oddest experience. And at the end of the meeting, we were sitting there, and he said, I have a gift for you. And he gave me a little brooch, which was, he said it was a copy. It was a pewter brooch. He said it was a copy of a medieval piece that was found on a pilgrim's path. He wouldn't tell me which one. And he said that there were 12 copies, and so there were 11 more copies. And he gave me this gift, and afterwards, you know, we all went to dinner, not Nick, but the three of us. And I said, did you guys just feel like your brains were, like, just connected to his? And they said, no. And I said, oh, my God. I said, there was something going on there. It was really bizarre. And I felt very much like he was using something like some kind of, you know, technique. And it seems like a lot of these secret society guys are sort of have heavy intelligence connections. And I was thinking about some, you know, like CIA techniques, like they use like cognitive interview, where they're able to sort of elicit information out of you without you even realizing it. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what's going on here? But it was really funny. But we had that connection on that very first meeting. And to this day, you know, we correspond quite regularly, you know, weekly or sometimes a couple times a week. Sometimes it'll be a couple of weeks, but we do stay in touch quite regularly. And it's sort of an odd pairing because he's this very erudite, aristocratic British fellow, you know, and I'm this, you know, farm girl from southeastern Oklahoma. Somehow we have a communication. It's very funny.
Yeah, but see, maybe your real history, Renee, is way back a long, long time ago, and you were part of this whole thing, is why it's so interesting to you and why you want to keep going and find out so much about it. So there could be some other connection there from a different lifetime or a lot of other things that could have actually formed without you even knowing. But one thing I know that some of the people do that are interviewing other people, if they actually look, and some people need to be a little aware of this because it's kind of freaky, and if you're aware of it, you'll know when it's going on. But they have a technique of looking from their left eye into your left eye, and it's almost like they're looking right into your soul. And if you're real aware of it, you can stop it because you'll get a real uncomfortable feeling. But if you're not aware of it, it's like you just want to talk and talk and go on and on and on. And it's a technique that they have been trained to use. And somebody tried it on me. Yeah, it's you can't tell, you know, that they're doing that because you're kind of looking with both eyes and they're looking with one eye. They're using their left eye in your left eye, which is kind of like goes into the part of your brain where they get to learn a lot of things, whether you say it or not.
I'm going to try that on somebody.
Yeah, it's really strange, you know, for the person who you're doing it to. Again, if they're aware of it, it's going to feel really strange. And the reason why I know is because somebody tried to do it to me. And it's like, you want to know things, you ask me. I will tell you anything you want to know. You don't go in there and try to pry. You know, so I just put up my protections, and all of a sudden the person kind of blinked and, you know, kind of freaked out a little bit, because I don't think that person was expecting me to do that. So, you know, just be a little aware of stuff like that, because they're trained with those kind of techniques, and most people don't know anything about them.
Yeah, absolutely. I know there's the things like that, and I didn't know about the left eye to left eye thing, but I'm going to keep my left eye out for that.
Just try it. When you try it, it'll take a couple times, because you have to kind of get your mind out of the way and just allow it to flow. But you'll know if that person truly is a happy soul or not a happy soul, because you'll get a really kind of good feeling inside when the person is and when they're not. It's like you get this harsh, you know, kind of like, to yourself. And that's how I knew that the person, but that's how I knew the person that was doing it wasn't doing it for the right reason, you know? And it's a couple that's pretty well known out there, and her husband's cheated on her a few times, so she tries to check out all the women by doing the left eye thing. And it's like, lady, you ask me what you want to know. So she doesn't speak to me anymore, and they won't have me on their show anymore, but that's okay. You know, that's all right. You got to set boundaries, but stuff like that happens. So let's talk a little bit about Jesus and Mary Magdalene with what you found. Now, do you believe that they were married?
I believe that it's more likely than not that Jesus was married. I mean, it would have been... As you know, Margaret Starbird, who's a wonderful author and an amazing researcher, I mean, Margaret, if she says something, you can pretty much take it to the bank. You know, she's checked it up, down, and sideways. And I like what she says about it. She said that if he was not married, that would have been so unusual that it would have been quite remarkable. And it would have been worthy of mentioning. But, however, the fact that it's not mentioned that he's married, she doesn't find that unusual, because he would have been expected to be married. There would have been no reason to think otherwise. It would have been very odd had he not been married. A Jewish man of that age, certainly a rabbi, which all indications sort of point that he was, he would have most definitely been married. And, you know, there's a huge debate, of course, on, you know, whether Jesus, you know, the historical Jesus existed, or whether he was amalgamation. I think Jesus, in my mind, did exist. I think part of the Jesus story is an amalgamation, just like, you know, there were so many stories about, you know, a prophet, a Messiah being born on December 25th of a virgin birth and all that. I think, we had Isis and Horus and Mithras and I forgot all the other ones. But so I believe they did take parts of the story and make it fit what people were used to, so that they would be comfortable with shifting over, you know, to Christianity. But I think it was not likely that he was married, and, you know, from everything that I know, if he was married, it's most likely that he was married to Mary Magdalene. And I don't think she was ever the prostitute that was talked about. In fact, the Catholic Church, I forgot what year it was, I think it was like 1969 or something, finally came out and said that woman, you know, the prostitute, was not Mary Magdalene. And that she was not a prostitute. But, of course, they don't advertise that, but they did agree that that's the truth. And so she actually, from what I know, was a woman of some means, and she was a priestess, probably of the Isis tradition.
Right. See, and I, with the people I've interviewed who've also talked about Jesus and our beginnings and everything else, you know, they're under the firm conviction that Jesus came from a very rich family, so that allowed him to do his travel. That part of his family owned, you know, like a big cargo company, you know, quote, as the time. And so he could travel very easily. And some of the things that happened around him just happened because, you know, he had already heightened his, you know, his senses and could do things. You know, and again, I don't know how true it is, but there's also in Santa Fe, New Mexico, there is a church
that, and I don't know the name of it. I've been there, but I don't remember the name. It has a staircase that supposedly was built by Jesus the carpenter. And the reason why this staircase...
Oh, I've heard that story.
It's so unique is because there isn't any center holding this stairway together. It's attached at the top and it's attached at the bottom, and it curves and makes this winding curve with nothing holding it. Okay.
I saw that, in fact, I saw that on an old episode of Unsolved Mysteries. They they did that. And this guy showed up and he made this incredible thing, and then he went away, right?
And they just called him Jesus the Carpenter. You know, and I don't know if it was Jesus. I mean, I don't, because I really haven't had enough time to go investigate a lot of things. But those are one of the stories that's going around. You know, my other thing is, if, you know, Jesus and Mary were married, why did they keep it so secret and so, you know, so quiet? Because, you know, people are going to find out.
Well, because if there were children, you know, those children would have been in great danger. And so, you know, that's how the story, you know, picks up, is that Mary Magdalene, either pregnant or already with children, with or without Jesus, fled and came to, you know, after the crucifixion or whatever happened, she fled and came to southern France. And it's amazing. You know, the area where we go is southwest France. It's in the Midi Pyrenees, and it's not Paris by any stretch of the imagination. It's small little villages all over, and with some amazing ruins and old Roman roads and all kinds of things. But the people there are very, very down to earth, salt of the earth people. They're farmers, you know, and there's not a lot of industry down there. And so they're just good, solid people, regular people. And they say, you know, well, of course they were here. Of course Mary Magdalene's here. And Jesus and the children, too. You know, they played in the meadow. And you're going to say, like, oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. So, like, the local stories... You know, and there's still a lot of, sympathizers, Cathar sympathizers that live there. And they proudly proclaim on signs by the road now, you know, you are in Cathar country, Pays de Cathar, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because, you know, of course, they were at once, you know, all murdered back in the Inquisition.
You know, and I mean, I know there's a lot of people who come up with many different theories about Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and God. I mean, they have theories all over the place. My one thought, and I, again, can't prove it, but when they talk about the four wise men following that bright star, what if that bright star happened to be a UFO that crashed? Wouldn't that change the story a lot, too?
Yeah. Or what if it was a UFO that was heralding, you know, whatever was happening down below, you know, drawing attention to it, and also guiding them, you know, if it, you know, maybe it was moving and they were following it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of theories to that, and I just, you know, because when you read the Bible and you hear about all these superpowers that Jesus was supposed to have had, you know, it would make perfect sense why he may not be from here.
Right. I mean, well, you know, we have all the, you know, ancient astronaut stories and the Anunnaki, and, you know, he could have been part of that bloodline.
Yeah, I mean,
he might not have been completely from here. Who knows?
Yeah, it's like different, and, you know, it's kind of fun and fascinating to come up with all these theories. Well, what if it was this, or what if it was that, and what if he was one of the first, you know, people who was born here as a hybrid, and, you know, on and on and on. So, I mean, with the people that I talk to, some of their theories are, you know, pretty far-fetched. But at the same time, most far-fetched theories usually pan out to be true, but they're so far-fetched nobody wants to believe them, so they're kind of left off to the side.
That's true. And also, I mean, you know, it's nice to, you know, to be able to speculate and to, you know, stretch your own mind like you were talking about earlier. You know, look for your own answers. You know, it's... People do, you know, and I think it's kind of a natural thing tend to want to follow somebody. They want you to tell them what to read, what to do, what to, you know. And really, if they do that, then they're on your path. They're not on theirs.
Right.
And so it's like, play with this information. See what resonates with you, you know. And maybe in the end, it doesn't matter what the hard facts are. Maybe what matters is where it gets us to in our own evolution.
Which is, everybody's trying to figure that out. And, you know, according to everybody else that I've talked to and I've interviewed, you know, this is supposed to be the time of great awakening and ascension and all that. And things come and go according to dates. And I don't really listen to any dates. I only go by what my own self tries to tell me. But, you know, there's a lot of supposedly truth that's going to be coming out as we get closer to 2012. Not because 2012 is going to be the end of the world, because it isn't. It's the end of what we know, the way we know it. So, but we only have like 4 minutes left. So I want you, Renee, to tell people how they can get in touch with you. Tell them where your radio station is at, and then real quick about your tours and how they can take them.
Oh, okay. The radio show is called Night Vision Radio, and it is broadcast live on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Pacific time on latalkradio.com. It's also available on iTunes, and then it's also available there on the archives the next day on latalkradio.com. You can also join me in, I have a live chat room going during the show at nightvisionproductions.com, and I try to work in questions and comments during that show. My film website is bloodlinethemovie.com, and I'm doing some construction on it. It should be back up tomorrow or Tuesday. And the movie can be purchased from Amazon or Netflix or Blockbuster. You can rent it or whatever you want to do. It's out there. So I hope that if you see it, I hope you like it. And the really big stuff is that what I've been really involved in is some research that's sort of bringing me to America with the Holy Grail story. It's really mind-blowing. And my partner, Gloria Amendola, who is up in Connecticut, and I do tours to these different, you know, places of, you know, great energy for the most part and great history. And we do tours to France and to the UK and to America this year. We're going to Oklahoma and Arkansas, and it's going to be really wild, and I'll let everybody know about that soon. But keep in touch with us, and if you want more information on the tours, you can go to GloriaAmendola.com, AmendolA.com.
Okay, it's called Bloodline Mystery Tours. Bloodline Mystery Tours?
Bloodline Mystery Tours, that's right.
Okay. So in the United States, hopefully, there's a lot of places in the United States that would probably be really, really interesting for you to go to. Yeah.
There really are. And, you know, I wouldn't mind coming out your way, too. There's some stuff around there, around Los Lunas, that I'd like to look into as well and develop that and, you know, see what's out there.
Well, see, we have a mystery rock here in Los Lunas. I've been to it a few times. And even people that live here, so, you know, don't necessarily know that it's there.
The one with the Hebrew? Is that the one with the Hebrew writing? Yes.
Yeah, there's like, it's got all this ancient Hebrew and some other kind of script on it. And some people say it's the Ten Commandments. I don't believe that because it doesn't feel like that to me. But there's actually three of the rocks there. And again, people don't know that, but I like to explore. So I went all over the mountain and everything else, even though I wasn't supposed to, but I didn't know that. So yes, there's a lot. So anytime you want to come out here, you let me know. You need to stay at my house because there's a lot of things that go on out here by my house, seeing how I'm the last house between my house and the mountains. There's nothing. And the mountains are about 10 miles away. So I get a lot of stuff. You know, so anytime you want to come, you're more than welcome to come. Just let me know. But I want to thank you. We have about 30 seconds left. I want to thank you for taking the time, Renee, to be on the show. It was very, very informative, and I love the things you're doing. So we're going to definitely stay in touch.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Got to get you back on my show again, too.
That would be cool. Anyway, you're very welcome. And now my time is up, so I just want to thank all the listeners. I hope they enjoyed it, and do the research like Renee has done and like what I do, and come up with your own answers. You might really be surprised at some of the answers you come up with. So may God bless all of you. Hope you have a great week, and we'll talk again soon. Take care. Bye now.